Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll be hearing from one of the great New Orleans poets, Peter Cooley, who teaches at Tulane University and whose new collection is called Night Bus to the Afterlife. Candace Huber tells us about FleurDeLitt.com and the Reading Between the Wines literary series, and we'll also hear from Thomas Brothers, whose fascinating new book is Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism. Poet Peter Cooley is the Senior Mellon Professor in the Humanities, a professor of English, and a director of creative writing at Tulane University. He's been at Tulane since 1975, and in that time, he's taught a number of our very best writers. He's the author of 9 books of poetry, the most recent of which is Night Bus to the Afterlife. Peter, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Yes, welcome back. I have to say, you know, for a while, you were only publishing books like every 10 years. And now you've speeded up a bit, which I'm very grateful for.
I must be getting older. It makes me write faster and faster.
You think? So tell us about the title, which is so evocative.
I'm very pleased with the title, actually. People ask me about the title, and the title just occurred to me one day in one of those moments when a moment of poetry, so to speak, and I knew it was to be the title of the book. It was just such a moment.
Was it a visual moment?
No, it was just the whole phrase. And actually, I have those phrases sometimes which become poems. Mm-hmm. I had one, I'm not going to tell you what it is, driving over here today just because of the sunshine or something like that. And someday I'm going to have an accident this way, but I always carry a notebook around with me. I pulled out my notebook and I wrote down what could be the title of another book to come. And then suddenly I realized the light had turned green. I got it down.
That gives new meaning to texting while driving.
It does. I've been texting for years.
Pull over when you have to do that.
Now, there's not time. It just comes to you in a flash. You have to do it instantly.
Right. Well, I wonder if you'd read the title poem to us so people will have a sense of what it's like.
Okay, sure. Night Bus to the Afterlife. There is the music of the cold stone floor, the greater music of the screw-in rack, sweetest music, the insignificance of what might go unnoticed but for you. This word darkness is afraid to speak to the fat lady who takes up 3 seats on the bus. You ask her to move over so the child on crutches can sit down. Most of our lives shine smaller than we think in light we never knew between the cracks the sidewalk offers up, where stars appear. I've seen the whole face of the sky some nights, depositing my small stash at the curb. Between spaces, I've seen constellations.
Most of our lives shine brighter than we think. That's why I love that poem,
of course. Thank you so much. It's really a poem about a man taking out the trash.
I know.
On Sunday night. That's all it is. He's just taking out the trash.
I have some of my best moments taking out the trash.
Me too. You know? Right. Epiphanies. Uh-huh.
Exactly.
Trash epiphanies.
Now, many of these poems continue themes that have long informed your work. We've had long conversations about the light.
The light, definitely.
In your work.
Mm-hmm.
And that ongoing conversation you have with God, you know, it's like the one Mary Oliver refers to as this long conversation in my heart.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in this collection as well, there are several poems about Katrina, specifically from 2005.
Yes. I think this is a post-Katrina book, really. It begins with Katrina, and Katrina is aftermath of Katrina is featured on the cover, but it's a post-Katrina and thereafter book, really. We have talked about the light before. The light has fascinated me ever since I got here, coming here from the Midwest, where it was bleak most of the time. I remember when I went to the University of Chicago, evening would begin around 2:30 mm-hmm. or 3, and night would come down like the lid on a pot, as Baudelaire describes it in Paris. But here, the afternoon goes on into the evening, into the golden hour, as the photographers call it. And the evening, is the light is very special.
And do you still have all those lamps in your office?
I do. In fact, I've added two more since that picture was taken.
I know. That's a really wonderful picture of you that was in the Times Picayune.
And yeah, with the suitcases, totally, too, piled up behind me. Like I'm going somewhere. I'm not going anywhere.
Suitcases and lamps to light your way. And yet, there's a lot of darkness in this book, a lot of deep, dark reckoning for you, isn't there?
Yes, I think. I mean, there's a lot of death in the book, too, and that comes from Katrina and the aftermath of Katrina and the shadows of growing older, definitely.
Mm-hmm. And you've been a poet for a long time now.
Too long, probably.
No,
I'm joking.
No.
No, I've been writing poetry since I was in... really about 13, 12 or 13. Mm-hmm. There.
So what do you feel you still have to learn?
Oh, everything. What I'm writing about. Someone said to me once, you know, you're only as good as the last poem you've written. Mm-hmm. So I have everything to learn, actually.
Oh, I don't know. You've been teaching everything you've learned so
well,
far.
I've been teaching poetry for a long, long time now.
And you hang out with a group of local poets.
We do.
Called
we do hang
Perkers?
Out. We're, the Perkers? The Perkers, yes. Well, it was named after City Perk, the coffee shop.
Oh.
But that lost its name after Katrina. So I still call it the Perkers, as if...
What does that do for you? Who is that group, and what do they mean to you?
They are thanked in here. We're meeting on Sunday, as a matter of fact. It's very important to me to have the group of very attentive poets whose work I admire and who are excellent writers themselves. And that's Brad Rashar and Carolyn Hembry. Andy Young is in the group, but she's in Egypt now.
Right.
And Andy Stallings and his wife, Melissa Dickey. We have had other people come and go from the group, but that's the group. And it's and Kay Murphy, how could I have forgotten her?
Oh, of course.
She wasn't there. Of course, she's been here forever. We meet every 2 weeks on a Sunday and just tear each other's work apart. But it's a supportive group. When I say tear each other's work apart, it's a very supportive group. So we support each other in our writing, too.
I think all those people are very generous people.
They are, all of them, very generous people.
So I wonder if you'd read one more poem for us. It's a poem that I love a lot because it's called The Happiness Poem.
Uh-huh.
And I remember once watching you wait for your kids to get out of school. And you were standing there pacing back and forth, and you looked like the perfect father.
Oh, I'm far from that.
We all are far from perfect parents. But still, I really love this poem.
Oh, it's hilarious that you would mention that because I was waiting for my son, Josh at Newman, and he just called me this afternoon, as a matter of fact, from California. He just finished Stanford Law School. But the sweet little child had many sarcastic comments to make.
He's old.
He's 29, so... And the poem is dedicated to Nicole, Alyssa, and Josh. Those are my three kids, who all think they're grown up.
Of course.
Mm-hmm. The happiness poem. What I like best, waiting for happiness. It's like the moment that just came to pass, the moment of the poem's clear silences. When I am there, I never know how wide, how high, how low, how full of infinite the sky can be. All I know is this light, rising and setting suns, one in its gaze. Even the desert prophets wanted God to walk among us, hungry, their feet sore, the Last Supper a rest for aching souls. Happiness, you're here, squalling to be fed, changed, held, read a story you can repeat. After your lunch, I'll put you down to nap. I'll have that quiet. When I just dreamed you.
We've been talking with the fabulous Peter Cooley, whose beautiful new collection is The Night Bus to the Afterlife. He'll be reading Monday, February 10th at 6 at Octavia Books. Thank you so much, Peter.
Thank you, Susan.
A literary community grows with the time and energy of many people. Writers, to be sure, and booksellers and librarians. And then there are the others, literary advocates who make things happen and who publicize literary events. Candace Huber is one of those people who's making things happen. In her day job, she's a technology project manager at Oxner, but in her spare time, it's taking up a lot of time, I know, she's begun a blog website, the cleverly titled fleurdelit.com. And more recently, she's expanded her activities to include producing a monthly reading series, Reading Between the Wines. Candace, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Now, you know that you founded Fleur de Lit almost 2 years ago, March 30th, 2012.
Yes.
What motivated you to get started doing this?
Well, I was searching the internet for literary events for myself to attend, and I had to go to a million different websites to find all the events. I had to go to all the bookstore websites and Gambit and NOLA.com and a little bit of everywhere to try and find the events that were going on around the city, and I just thought, this is ridiculous. I wish there was one place to go to find all the literary events going on. And then I thought, well, I could do that. That's something that I could do. So my husband is actually a computer programmer. So I talked to him about helping me to design and program a website, and he thought it was a good idea, and it was kind of born from there.
I think of you as a technology maven, girl, let me tell you. Now, you put on your website, fleurdelit.com, your five fundamentals, which I love. So I wish you'd talk a little bit about those five things for me.
Yes. So the five fundamentals are: we endorse local, we love New Orleans, the book is always better than the movie.
Amen.
Freedom of speech is essential to society, and the attractiveness of correct grammar cannot be overstated. And those fundamentals, when I was thinking about why I wanted to do this and, you know, what my sort of mission would be with Fleur de Lit in general, these are the things that I thought of. You know, I really want to help local New Orleans literary community, and I'm just a firm believer in my personal life that the book is always better than the movie. I can't think of any examples where it's not. And with the correct grammar and freedom of speech, I think freedom of speech is obviously extremely essential to society, and I'm what most people might call a grammar Nazi. So
we need more grammar Nazis, yes. I think. So you got Fleur de Lit going. It's been going for almost 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then last November, you branched out to producing literary events. What drew you to that side of things?
When Maple Street Bookshop pulled out of Mid-City, there was sort of a hole that I saw in Mid-City because there aren't any bookstores there anymore. There weren't really any literary events going on. When I started noticing, a lot of the literary events were sort of concentrated to uptown, downtown, you know, and then out in the suburbs. So Mid-City, there was sort of a hole there as far as literary events go. And my friend Leora Madden owns Pearl Wine Company. And so I approached her about possibly doing a reading series there, and she was on board with the idea. So the two of us sort of just got together and decided to kind of fill that gap in the community for Mid-City, and it's been going really well so far.
So what was the first one? What was the November event?
So the November event was just, we called it our kickoff event. We had George Bishop, his most recent book is Night of the Comet. We had David Armand, whose book was Harlow. And we had an author called Chuck Husmeyer, and his book was The Axeman of New Orleans. And that was really interesting. The authors were really engaged, and it was a lot of fun.
And then in December, you had practically an author-palooza.
We did. So in December was our food event, and so we had Poppy Tooker and Elsa Hahn from Offbeat Magazine, and she wrote a book called The Gravy about New Orleans musicians, which is a great book. And then we also had the authors of the French Quarter Drinking Companion, and it was a lot of fun. So we talked about food and drink. And then January was kind of our author-palooza.
Another author-palooza.
We had six authors in January, and we talked about New Orleans history. And that was our most well-attended so far. It's been growing steadily each month. So our last one, January, had about 50 people, which was a lot of people to have at the event. So we're having a lot of fun with it.
And for that one, you had Larry Powell and Rebecca Snedeker and Emily Clark.
Yes. And Lisa Marie Brown. We also had Randy Fertel and Carolyn Cobb as well.
That's a full slate.
Yes.
So what's coming up in February?
So in February, we have a romance event for Valentine's Day. It's on February 12th and sponsored by the Women's National Book Association. And we'll have a romance and chocolate event where we'll have romance authors, poetry readings, wine, and chocolate. So the authors attending, we have Farrah Rochon. Her new book is A Forever Kind of Love. We also have Alice Kemp, and her book is called The Red Halter Top. And we also have Gina Ferrara, who is a local poet, and her book is Amber Porchlight. We have Roger Kamenetz, another local poet, and his book is To Die Next to You. And then we have Susan Weaver, who writes as Viola Russell, and her book is called The Ice Wagon and the Clubhouse. So it should be a really fun event.
So that's February 12th at 6:30
yes.
at Pearl Wines. So tell me about your own literary life. What literary groups do you belong to?
So I belong to the Women's National Book Association. I also belong to the SOLA, which is the Romance Writers of America's local group here.
And that's one of the oldest and strongest writing groups in the city.
Yes, it's a great writing group there. And I also belong to the writers group at the Jefferson Parish Library as well.
And they're starting to get some books out from that group, I think.
Yes.
It's really amazing.
It is.
So what are your writing aspirations?
I am in the process of writing a novel right now based in the middle of Katrina, sort of like a suspense thriller that I'm in the process of writing. I also really like to write flash fiction, which are the short stories. That's really fun as well. So I'm constantly writing. I've been writing my entire life, and I really like to read. So hopefully one day I can get my stuff out there as well.
Well, you do it all. So thanks for doing Fleur de Lis, which is really a great project. And Reading Between the Wines is making a lot of people happy every month. We've been talking with Candace Huber, who's the founder of Fleur de Lis. You can meet her at the next reading of Between the Wines. That event is February 12th at 6:30 at Pearl Wine Company. That's at 3700 Orleans Avenue. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Susan.
It's my great pleasure to talk with Thomas Brothers, who's a professor of music at Duke University. Tom is the author of a book I so enjoyed, Louis Armstrong's New Orleans, as well as Louis Armstrong in his own words. He's joining us today to talk about his fascinating new work, massively detailed and wonderfully insightful, called Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism. Thomas Brothers, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Now, all I can say is, what a labor of love this is. This book is more than 500 pages devoted to a relatively short but wildly significant period in Armstrong's life, the 20s and the 30s.
Well, thank you. Yeah, you know, I was telling somebody about my book the other day that this is my third book on Louis Armstrong. And she said, that's pretty obsessive. I said, you know, but it has never felt like that to me, because what I try to do is establish the context of his life, and the context is so rich. The New Orleans context was unbelievably rich. I mean, that was a tremendous discovery for me to learn all about that. And this is also, I mean, it goes in so many different directions. As you said, it covers about 10 years. It's 1922 or so to 1932. And those are really the glory years of his career, as far as I'm concerned. That's the music that is still makes him, I would say, perhaps the most important jazz musician in the history of jazz. So it was a lot of fun from both angles, you know, from the historical context and the historical issues that come up, and, of course, getting into the music in a lot of detail.
Now, you placed him so strongly in that New Orleans milieu in the last book. And in this, you know, things are expanding outwards as you place him in the context of the Great Migration.
Yeah, when he moved to Chicago in 1922, he was not at the cutting edge of the Great Migration. It had already been going on for, you know, a good 5 or 6 years and really picking up a lot of momentum. And so he steps into a situation that is ready for him, really, in a lot of ways. The South Side of Chicago is filling up with people from the South, and a lot of people from Louisiana, in fact. So the musicians who had started to go from New Orleans to Chicago as early as 1915 or so, it's hard to know exactly how many there were there when he arrived, but it could be 30 to 40, a nice collection of musicians from New Orleans, from his peer group, really. So he stepped into this situation, and they were doing extremely well, playing music for all these recently arrived people from the South. Very blues-based music at places like Lincoln Garden. And as I say, the situation was really ready for him, so it was a great moment. I mean, you know, a lot of people moved to the North for different reasons, really as an escape as much as anything. For him, it wasn't an escape. It was an attraction to really excellent paying jobs and actually with and stepping into a band with his mentor, Joe Oliver. So that was an added bonus for him.
Now, as you write in this book, modernism can be a loaded term for the historian, and you're very precise in what you see as Armstrong's modernist contributions. One of the things you wrote that was so interesting was that musical style can demonstrate how music accomplishes cultural work at a very deep level, and that's true of Armstrong, because his music accomplished this cultural work throughout his life. And this was at a time when racial attitudes were changing and when, as you say, it was dangerous to be intelligent, assertive, and black.
Well, first of all, the 1920s is full of modern. It's a modern period. The 20s loved to think of itself as modern, and there were a lot of inventions going on. There was a lot of flashy new things, including jazz. That was one of the modern things of the period. Armstrong was marketed. The phrase I used, master of modernism, was how he was marketed, actually. And I don't think anybody balked at that. And at that period, that's the early 30s, and that's when he's trying to reach white audiences. I think people absolutely accepted him as modern. But the amazing thing is, in a way, that they accepted him at all because his music was so radical, in a sense. And he was performing a lot of popular tunes that they knew and understood. But he was, as someone said, he was fracturing them in typical Negro style, meaning that he was paraphrasing them heavily, adding a lot of blue notes, adding a lot of rhythmic activity that wasn't part of the original song, adding a lot of complicated phrasing, distorting the words. In other words, it was a real radical transformation, and it was a really black transformation. It was a very, as what they would have said at the period, is extremely Negro music, is how they describe it. So at a very deep level, at the level of musical style, he is presenting what people perceived as authentic African-American, even authentic African, people talk mm-hmm. about him like that, music. And so that's why I say it's amazing that they accepted him because of this radical kind of musical style that he was bringing to the country. In 1932, he sold more records than anybody in the United States, any kind of music. So that's a really incredible moment for the history of our country, I would say.
And you break it down to two major modernist contributions, don't you?
Yeah, I like to think of it in two phases for this period that I'm writing about, 1922 to 1932. And the first great peak of his career is actually the Hot Fives in 1926, 1927. That's the period of Big Butter and Eggman, Potato Head Blues, Struggling with Some Barbecue, West End Blues. These pieces are very famous. And I argue that those pieces really came out of a patronage base of the black community in Chicago, that was his main audience at places like the Savoy Ballroom in Chicago. This is a massive ballroom holding thousands of people, and it's all black, absolutely all black. I mean, it's not that whites couldn't enter, but it's very rare to see white people there. A few white musicians would go down and hear him play, and they talk about what it was like there. So this is the community that is supporting him and nurturing this music, and he's responding to this community with what we know now as the Hot Five and Hot Seven recording. So that's, I'm calling that, is sort of his first modern phase, which was also very radical in a sense. And also, it would be a mistake to think that people automatically like that, even in this community. It was hard for them to get used to it because it was so radical. It was an experiment. It was an avant-garde kind of adventure in a lot of ways. And some of the musicians talk about that. They say, well, it was easier to hear Joe Smith. It was easier for people to listen. He was a rival trumpet player because Joe Smith's phrasing is tidier, it's neater, he's closer to the tune, he's easier to follow in that sense. And what Armstrong was doing was experimenting with really kind of radical stylistic innovation, and as the results were, that made him the most important soloist in jazz at that period.
So what's next for you? Will you be following him into the next chapter of his life?
No, I don't think so. In fact, I'm working on now is a book on Duke Ellington and the Beatles.
Oh, fun. and different.
Yeah, it is different. Yeah, it's called The Beatles, Duke Ellington, and the Magic of Collaboration.
Ah, that will be an interesting change. I have to say, this is a little bit obsessive because you really want your readers to appreciate his musical innovations. So you have CD notations right down to the second in this book.
Yeah, you know, we didn't want to have musical examples in notation in the book because most of the readers won't read musical notations. So this seemed like a way for me to be able to talk about with some precision about what passages I'm referring to. And a way for readers to be able to get into that.
Well, I spent a lot of time listening to Cornet Chop Suey yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Which was so much fun. It was fun to do. So I think your book will drive readers back to the music, which is so wonderful. And that's what you want, really.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We've been talking with Duke University music professor Thomas Brothers, whose wonderful new book is Louis Armstrong, Master of Modernism. Thank you so much, Tom.
Well, thank you, Susan. I appreciate it.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Wendy Webb signs The Vanishing, Tuesday, February 4th at 6 at Octavia Books. George Fowler III signs My Cuba Libre, bringing Fidel Castro to justice, Tuesday, February 4th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Errol Laborde, author of Mardi Gras, Chronicles of the New Orleans Carnival, discusses the food associated with carnival season, Tuesday, February 4th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. His appearance is part of the Culinary Legacy series hosted by Liz Williams, founder and president of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Poet Brenda Marie Osby presents a reading from her work, Tuesday, February 4th at 7:30 at Woldenberg Arts Center at Tulane University. Batty Pack signs Here I Am, The Abraham Legacy, a novel about letting go, Wednesday, February 5th at 5 at Barnes & Noble in Metairie. Joshua Field Milburn and Ryan Nicodemus discuss Everything That Remains, Wednesday, February 5th at 6:30 at Maple Street Bookshop. Errol Barron, professor of architecture at Tulane University, discusses his book, Roma Osservata, Rome Observed, at 6:30 Wednesday, February 5th at East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Michael Murphy and contributors sign Eat Dat New Orleans, Thursday, February 6th at 6 at Octavia Books. Peter Ricciuti discusses and signs Stocks Under Rocks, How to Uncover Overlooked Profitable Market Opportunities, Thursday, February 6th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop. Diane de las Casas signs her new children's book, Cinderelephant, Saturday, February 8th at 1:30 at Octavia Books. Alan G. Gothrow signs Italian Louisiana, History, Heritage, and Tradition, Sunday, February 9th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. Poet Jacob Dilson reads from his work, followed by an open mic, Sunday, February 9th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Today's guest, Peter Cooley, signs Night Bus to the Afterlife, Monday, February 10th at 6 at Octavia Books. Arthur and Pauline Frommer sign Frommer's Travel Guides, Tuesday, February 11th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Kim Marie Voss discusses The Baby Doll, Breaking the Race and Gender Barriers of the New Orleans Mardi Gras Tradition, February 6th at noon at the State Library Seminar Center in Baton Rouge. She will also appear at Author Night, Tuesday, February 11th at 6:30 at the Hubble Branch Library in Algiers Point. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.